Reaction to unfolding allegations about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Over the weekend, The New Yorker published an article about a second woman who has come forward with a new allegation of sexual misconduct against Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Deborah Ramirez recounts an incident during undergraduate years at Yale. This came as the Senate Judiciary Committee was negotiating hearings to address claims put forward by another woman, Christine Blasey Ford, who is scheduled at this point to testify on Thursday. And it appears there may be others as well. I'm Jennifer Rooks. All of these allegations bring up a lot of questions about the timeline of the Supreme Court nomination, the ability to determine someone's credibility, the nature of memory itself, the politics of the allegations, and more. Today, we'll discuss these questions with three experts. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As the events surrounding the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court confirmation continue to unfold, we are going to devote today's program to analyzing some of these issues. Joining me in the studio today, Julie Longua Peterson. She's Associate Professor of Psychology and Program Director of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of New England. Christine Thibault is Cumberland County Assistant District Attorney and Supervising Attorney for the Juvenile Unit. And Ron Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about all the news unfolding over the past week surrounding Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. I know you're all here on pretty short notice, and we really do appreciate it. Ron, I want to start with you, and I want to ask each of you the same first question. As you watch this, you know, as a political science professor, what are you thinking about as you watch these allegations unfold, these negotiations over if and when to have hearings in the Judiciary Committee?
Well, as a political scientist, I worry about the court. Hamilton, all the way back in the Federalist Papers, talked about how the court had a problem among our institutions because it doesn't have the power of the purse like Congress or the power of the sword like the executive branch. There was a lot of concern right from the beginning, therefore, about upholding the perceived legitimacy of the court, of the idea that it was a neutral institution that wasn't political. And that has been frayed, let me put it that way, in the last, I guess, since Bush v. Gore, really. Particularly because Congress is so hopelessly polarized right now between the parties that a lot of issues, a lot of fights that I think probably should be happening in Congress are winding up being kicked down the street to the court. I heard, I think it was Senator Orrin Hatch say last week that he wants to hear from Dr. Blasey Ford, but that he can't see how his opinion on Brett Kavanaugh would be changed. And to me, that suggests that an incredibly important decision about the composition of the court is being made with an eye towards a partisan lens, and there's less and less of an attempt to pretend that that's not what's happening. And I think that's bad for the court, and I think it's bad for our politics.
Julie, as a psychology and gender studies professor, what are you thinking about right now?
Yeah, I think two main thoughts that I have at the moment are, you know, I've been asking myself and asking my colleagues, you know, their thoughts on whether we need an external investigation by the FBI into the accusations made by Blasey Ford. And I think one of the reasons I'm so interested in this question has to do with the literature and the science behind judgment and decision making. And given that senators on both sides of the aisle have expressed pretty openly that their opinions, whether it is we either don't believe or don't care what Dr. Blasey Ford has to say because we want to push Kavanaugh through, or we believe Dr. Blasey Ford, that those sort of decisions already made are going to impact their ability to know what questions to ask during the hearing, to you know, accurately and without bias evaluate the information. You know, I do think an external body that is investigating these claims and this aspect or this side of Justice Kavanaugh's past is important and integral to the process of decision making and should hopefully provide more information both for the general public and for lawmakers. And then the second part of it, I think, which is more that sort of women and gender studies hat that I also wear is, you know, people's reactions to the allegations made by Dr. Blasey Flohr and then this additional woman, Ramirez, you know, the skepticism and the slate of questions that we almost always hear. Why didn't she report earlier? Or she is, you know, after power or after money and sort of unpacking where those kind of claims or skeptics come from or those skeptic thoughts.
Mm-hmm. And Christine Thibault, bringing you into the conversation as a prosecutor, how are you looking at all of this?
Well, as a juvenile prosecutor, I spend most of my time trying to debunk myths about kids and the trouble they may get into. And a lot of kids think, well, what I do as a juvenile doesn't really matter because it all just mysteriously disappears when I turn 18. And so this case is a little bit unusual because it's showing that there are very real consequences to conduct that you may engage in as a teenager. And to follow up on what Julie was saying about the why wasn't this reported sooner, and we're talking about an incident, at least one incident that occurred 36 years ago and the other a little more recently, but what we know about teenagers, victims, they do not think of police as problem solvers. They don't report incidents to law enforcement and often not even to authorities within their school. A lot of teens, especially I think girls, feel a great deal of shame, and they don't share this information. That is not at all unusual. On the other hand, we have a situation where a person, Judge Kavanaugh, engaged in behavior when he was young, and typically our juvenile justice system is designed to address those behaviors but not have it destroy a person's lives. And we've sort of missed that opportunity here to address that alleged bad behavior in a meaningful way that brings the victim some healing but also allows the offender to better choices in life and overcome that.
So many questions on so many layers about this and so much of a conversation going on throughout the nation. Christine, turning back to you, one of the big questions, and we've touched on this a little bit, is this call to have the FBI investigate. I think when the first accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, said, "I want to testify, but only after an FBI investigation," that surprised a lot of people, and people are sort of processing that. Why would someone want an FBI investigation, and do you think it's a good idea?
Well, I guess it depends on what the FBI is charged with investigating. If they're charged with investigating what happened on that given night, I would suggest that they may be able to find people who corroborate one side or the other, and that may be useful information. But to get at what really happened and, you know, who was there and what should be done about it. The FBI doesn't investigate criminal matters of that nature, even for adults. And so when you overlay the fact that these were adolescents, and I don't believe that the FBI is probably very well schooled in adolescent development and why a person may not report a crime which allegedly was pretty serious, I'm not sure the FBI is really the right bureau to be investigating this claim for its for truth of the matter.
How do you determine, as a prosecutor, whether dealing with juvenile cases or others, when someone is credible and when someone is not credible?
That's not for the prosecutor to decide. That's what the fact finder, whether that's a judge in the juvenile case, we have judges who are the fact finder, or in the adult criminal system, it's often a jury. And that's their job. And so we as prosecutors look at the evidence. And is there sufficient evidence to prove a charge beyond a reasonable doubt? Is there a reasonable likelihood of success? And often that's difficult if you don't have any corroborating evidence for a victim's claim.
Julie, from your perspective as a psychologist, this whole idea of credibility, is this something that is determinable?
Well, I mean, I think... there's no hard yes or no, I think, answer to that question. But I do think just thinking about Christine's point that there's no jury in this particular case, right, in the Kavanaugh hearings, there is no jury and there is no judge in this case, right? We have the Senate Judiciary Committee who is, in, you know, investigating in some ways. And I think the question is whether they're the appropriate body to investigate or look for truth. I think, you know, that they may not be going into this with an eye for truth, but rather with an eye for confirming their existing biases. You know, we know very well in the psychology literature that people search for, interpret, favor, and recall better information that's consistent with their pre-existing beliefs. And senators who have made evident what their pre-existing beliefs are might not be equipped to accurately determine what is the truth here. And so maybe if the FBI is not the right body to do that, I'm not totally sure who is. But I think that both Kavanaugh's side as well as Dr. Blasey Ford's side need to be contextualized in a larger set of information and facts in order for any real truth to come out of this. And I think that's really important.
And Ron, the court that we're talking about in this case is not a court of law, but a Senate Judiciary Committee, and also really the court of public opinion, to use a cliche.
Yeah, I think Julie's point there is exactly right about the need for us to contextualize what's happening. My concern with bringing in the FBI and with the sort of language of a court of law is that we're going to shift to thinking of Judge Kavanaugh as someone who deserves reasonable doubt. As though this were a case determining whether or not he was going to be imprisoned, rather than whether or not the Senate will consent to him having a lifetime appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And do you think that conversation has already shifted that way?
Do I?
Yeah. Is this the way that you are hearing this discussed?
Yes. I'm hearing it discussed that way. I think, too, because of the talk about impeachment, that there's a lot of blurring in the way people are talking about events in the Trump administration between frames of reference that are applicable to court cases and ones that essentially have to do with politics and with political institutions.
If you'd like to join the conversation, phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Ron, we now have two allegations, possibly more. The attorney Michael Avenatti is hinting that there are more women who are talking to him. Just read this morning that there's another case in Montgomery County, Maryland, that the detectives down there are looking into. Is there a number at which it becomes too much and Brett Kavanaugh withdraws?
Honestly speaking, just from a partisan point of view, I'm a little surprised the Republicans aren't already looking for an exit on this situation, because more cases can certainly come out. I imagine they don't want to be in a position of looking like they don't take that seriously. The longer this drags out, the more danger there is of Republican candidates like this Representative Kramer, I think, in North Dakota, saying incredibly objectionable things about sexual assault and sexual abuse. Just from the sheer arena of political strategy, I feel like the GOP would be well advised at this point to have Kavanaugh withdraw his name and turn to other candidates who, frankly, are going to share his judicial philosophy.
And Julie, you see politics around the very question of whether or not we believe Dr. Blasey Ford.
Yeah, I mean, I think as with many things that are happening today, the truth of whether she has or has not been sexually assaulted by Kavanaugh has been politicized. So in order to be a Republican, you must stand behind Kavanaugh and that the allegations are false. In order to be a Republican, you must believe, you know, what Democrats are saying. And so I think there's this partisan divide in terms of people's ability to see the truth here, or to want to see the truth, or to engage in controlled, effortful information processing to gather all of the facts and make decisions. Now, regardless, I think, of party affiliation, many of us, use stereotypes to fill in the blanks. And so, you know, we don't know a lot about Dr. Blasey Ford. And so stereotypes about women and what women are like are going to fill in those blanks. And given that there are pretty pervasive stereotypes of women as being, you know, emotional or dramatic or, anything less than rational, you know, people are using those stereotypes to then discredit her, as has been done in the past with other women who have come forward with sexual assault allegations. And I think, you know, added to that is something we call a belief in a just world. And that is, you know, again, regardless of party affiliation, people tend to believe that bad things happen to bad people and good things happen to good people. And in the idea that bad things happen to bad people, it's not just bad people, but maybe people who made bad decisions or, you know, are flawed in some way. And that can lead to victim blaming. And so I think we're seeing a lot of, you know, maybe Republicans at this point, but I don't think it's probably, I think there are probably Democrats who believe this too, that perhaps Blasey Ford did something wrong to deserve this. Or, you know, the fact that she didn't report is an indication of her fault in this as well.
And Christine, I'm going to turn to you with this. Is this something that you see coming up in cases that you handle with this idea of victim blaming?
Yes. Yes, I think so. And especially, frankly, when alcohol is involved, and that sort of taints everybody's memory and motives. And so, yeah, it's common.
How difficult is it for you, Christine, to have sexual assault survivors step forward and prosecute their case?
It's very difficult. And part of the difficulty, I think, is knowing that it's an uphill battle for them. And first, they have to share their vulnerabilities with someone who may or may not be sensitive to what they've gone through. And then we have to meet and discuss legal issues, which are very different than emotional issues. And oftentimes victims want to come to court to the Judiciary Committee as well, and they want some sort of emotional satisfaction that the wrong has been righted. And unfortunately, the legal system doesn't play on that turf. It's more about evidence and what can we present, and I suspect that the committee hearing will be the same. And so the emotional satisfaction one hopes to get through the legal process is often not there. And so I think victims understand that, and victims' parents. I deal often with parents of young people who have been victimized, and it's difficult for them as well as the victim. They want that wrong to be righted.
And it still is difficult, even though we like to think as a society we've made progress.
It's still difficult, yes, absolutely.
And Ron, before we go to a break, the political calculation here, it seems as though the only reason that the Republican senators want to have this hearing this week and have the vote as soon as possible is the midterm elections. Is that an accurate calculation, or is there more going on here?
It does seem that way, yes. I believe that probably is accurate. But even if it is inaccurate, that's a huge problem for the Republicans in the Senate as well. Because if people feel that a decision of this monumental in nature and in the face of accusations of this kind of crime are being considered by the members of the Judiciary Committee on the basis of the election calendar, that's going to make their decisions look compromised.
We're talking about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and the allegations that have surfaced in the last week or so. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, and please keep an email brief, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Nome Landscapes, dedicated to enhancing outdoor living in Maine with installation, design, masonry, and maintenance. NomeLandscapes.com. Berenson Associates, Freeport Village Station, where the Carters and Oshkosh Bagosh Outlet is now open. OneFreeportVillageStation.com. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com.
Kim Jong-un has decreed North Korea will focus not on building nuclear weapons, but on building the economy. When we visited, they showed us farms and factories.
They want to be able to say, hey, we don't need your goods. You can sanction us all you want. And so part of the reason for showing you that is to show off their ability to make their own products.
Measuring progress by GDP, not missile tests, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. Are you interested in traveling to Sicily? Maine Public Travel is headed to Sicily next May on another of our cultural explorations to this fascinating island. You're invited to join Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz and other friends of Maine Public. Our Many Flavors of Sicily 10-day tour will involve sightseeing, tours, lectures, and music that will offer insight and understanding of Sicily and its people. Learn more about Maine Public's Sicily tour by visiting our website, mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, a conversation about the questions raised by the Kavanaugh controversy. Joining me in the studio, Christine Thibault, Assistant District Attorney and Supervising Attorney for the Juvenile Unit at Cumberland County. Julie, did I pronounce your name wrong? Longjue?
It's Longjue.
Longjue Peterson is an Associate Professor of Psychology and Program Director of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of New England. And Ron Schmidt, a Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine and the author of the new book, Reading Politics with Machiavelli. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to start with an email from Tyler. Earlier today, I was hearing lots of support for Dr. Ford and the new accuser. Neither of them have been willing to say under oath that their story is true. There are people on the left now calling for Dr. Ford to not testify on Thursday. There are people asking for an FBI investigation, but the FBI doesn't investigate teen groping allegations. I listened to the obstruction at the hearings for Judge Kavanaugh, and I've concluded that these new allegations are simply the next step that the left are taking. There's no credibility to the allegations until accusers testify under oath, as the accused already have. I want to believe women when they say they've been wronged, but I just can't in this case. Julie, does Tyler have a point that somebody needs to testify under oath to have any credibility?
I mean, in my professional and personal opinion, I don't think so. I think that I think his concerns are valid. I see him seeking, his concerns in terms of wanting someone to testify, to give something tangible to say, like, oh, this person went under oath and therefore I believe them. I think that's a pretty high bar to have for someone who has been traumatized, to expect that they would willingly and voluntarily relive that trauma in a public court and a court of public opinion as well. And so I would caution him to maybe take a little bit of a step back and think about, you know, what would it be like if he were the victim of sexual assault, and would he want to relive it in that way? We hold a really high standard for believing women, and particularly women who are survivors of sexual assault. And I don't know that that bar is as high as, I don't know if the bar that we're holding for Kavanaugh and whether we believe him is quite as high as the bar we're holding to his survivors. I think Anita Hill recently said something to the effect of, you know, sitting on the Supreme Court is not an entitlement. It's something that's earned. And I truly believe that if Brett Kavanaugh is to be confirmed, then we should, as a public, feel confident that we are putting into court someone who is not just the brightest and the best, but also someone who has a really strong moral and ethical compass. And so when these types of accusations come to light, you know, it is worth investigating. And ultimately, hopefully, we will have more information to make a better judgment about whether the allegations are true or false. But I would, you know, just caution the listener to maybe step back and not form a judgment quite yet. It also sometimes is useful if you just flip the story players in any scenario. So would he feel the same if it was, a democratically controlled Senate and a Democratic president who had a nominee for the Supreme Court who had been accused of sexual assault? Would this individual have the same level of doubt for an accuser in that scenario as they do in this scenario? And to maybe flip that script and ask ourselves where our own biases lie can be sort of helpful.
We'll go to Jenny calling from Portland. Hi, Jenny. Go ahead.
Hi. Kind of to answer the previous emailer, I have PTSD, or I live with sexually called CPTSD, complex PTSD, from early childhood sexual assault. And though I'm having a great life and I've managed to do well for myself, even having this story going on in the public with Kavanaugh, I find myself triggered throughout the day. I get more emotional when I was trying to picture what it would be like to sit in a room in front of a group of men, especially, who were listening to me tell my story and asking me very intimate questions that are already, it would make me seriously want to throw up and hide under the table. That is what my body would want to do. So I think people really don't understand that for someone who's been sexually traumatized, there's a whole load of things that are happening in your body, and this all because of the shame that our society puts on this. So the fact that his first accuser didn't tell her parents or her siblings until this all came out shows how deeply hidden it was. And my reason for wanting Kavanaugh to be thoroughly investigated is because if for some reason this person is just a wild card, or these few people are just wild cards and they're not telling the truth, then we should find that out. But if there is anything in Kavanaugh's history of being kind of in the good old boys club and getting girls drunk and having sex with them or groping them or whatever, I would personally feel as though I am completely unrepresented by my own Supreme Court, because how there's already one man on the bench that's questionable of whether or not he understands what it's like to be a female and to have sexual assault done to you.
Jenny, thank you so much for your call. Response from you all.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you, Jenny, for calling in, because that couldn't have been easy to even enter the public arena that much to talk about something like this. And I think that really, again, points to the also, I'm thinking here about what Tyler had to say. I think that a service the FBI could really be doing here, if we don't think of it as investigating criminal activity with an expectation of conviction, but that they are in a place where they can provide more information to the members of the Judiciary Committee that they should take into consideration before they take a vote of this kind of significance, to find out more about the troubling allegations that are being brought to the fore just seems to me like a basic responsibility.
Ron, is whatever happens here going to fuel the partisan divide if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed or if he withdraws his nomination?
I think it will add to the intensity of the partisan divide. But also what I think is more troubling is that as our politics have become more deeply partisan, even in regard to issues of fact, the independence of the court and the kind of role the court plays in our lives has been cast in a similar light. I think if the GOP insists on pushing Kavanaugh through despite these allegations onto the court, that's only going to add to the degree to which people see the court as a political body and not a juridical one.
Ron, you may be able to speak more to this because this is more in your area of expertise than mine, but this is also a relatively recent phenomenon with the restructuring of how the Senate can vote on Supreme Court nominees. So now they need a simple majority, and which makes it easier, I think, to play a little bit of partisan politics with Supreme Court nominees.
You're exactly right. That's a very recent change. To get rid of the possibility of senators to filibuster nominees to the Supreme Court does make this look like other kinds of more politically or partisan decided decisions. And I think that is problematic for the court itself in the future. And I think it also weakens what historically the role of the Senate has been. The Senate isn't just a legislative majoritarian body like the House. Its role is supposed to be more deliberative. That's why, for example, it gets to decide on the question of nominees to the Supreme Court. The Constitution reserves for the Senate the power of advice and consent, which means that they deliberate on these choices. I think that the GOP here and the president are showing, again, a lack of understanding what consent really means. They seem to think that consent in this case means that if they bring forward a nominee they think deserves a place on the court, that that becomes an entitlement that the rest of the Senate is meant to oblige. The consent means you have the power to say yes. But if you say no, they're going to see that as an unjust attack.
A tweet from Nina for all three panelists. How do you think things have changed since the candidacy hearing of Clarence Thomas and the testimony of Anita Hill? Ron?
Well, I think there is a sense, even among the members of the Judiciary Committee who were here, who were there in 1991, that they at least need to be aware of the potency of these kinds of charges, that they have to in some way consider the power of women and the expectation of women, and as Jenny put it, the idea of representing women in these decisions. At this point, that might just mean that they bring in a woman attorney to question Dr. Blasey Ford. But I think there is an idea that women are in and of themselves a more powerful and significant voting bloc. President Trump won election with a majority of white women voters. That status is currently in danger. That potentially weakens his case for 2020. And it's something that I'm sure the Republican leadership in the Senate are concerned with. For the Democrats, too, the Anita Hill episode in 1991 was shameful and was seen as such almost immediately. That's where the 1992 Year of the Woman came from. And I think that's a memory that is still very powerful within their minds.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, as much as we might think things have changed, I'd also think it's worth noting that, you know, when you actually look up the makeup of the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, 17 of the members of that committee are older white males. There are only 4 women and only 3 people of color. And so I think if we're really serious about asking whether it's changed, I mean, I don't think the makeup of our government has changed that much. We simultaneously have a president who's tweeting, if this was true, why didn't she come out with this earlier? I think when you put those two realities next to each other, I mean, I do think it becomes more difficult to make claims that women get a better or more fair shake than they did in previous decades. I'm not sure you could make that argument legitimately.
I have a tweet from Catherine. I have yet to hear anyone who is willing to disregard Kavanaugh's teen indiscretion mention the fact that we charge minors as adults in our justice system every day. A different accountability?
Well, for this particular incident, assuming it happened as alleged, you know, trying a juvenile as an adult is not an easy task. There are many legal hurdles to getting a juvenile tried as an adult. That said, some states automatically try 17-year-olds and a couple of states even 16-year-olds as adults. So, you know, and to do it now, I would venture to guess there's a statute of limitations that would prohibit any criminal prosecution of Mr. Kavanaugh. But, I'm not sure what she's alluding to there, but trying him as an adult for something that happened then is not likely to happen. Even, frankly, even if it was investigated immediately after it occurred, I'm not certain that would have come up. Now, the interesting question might be, let's assume for a moment that Ms. Blasey Ford reported to the police right away or through her parents reported to the police and the case was investigated and Judge Kavanaugh was found as a juvenile to have committed this act. Would that then preclude him from earning the success that he has earned? I think if we eliminated everyone from success based on what they do when they're 16 or 17 years old, we'd have really very few successful people in the world. So, you know, the question is, for me as a prosecutor, is how do we respond to very bad behavior by teenagers in a way that holds them accountable? It brings the victim some healing and yet doesn't destroy futures unnecessarily. Now, maybe in this case, certainly we don't know what happened on that night. Maybe it would be necessary to destroy this man's future. But
we'll go to Bob in Portland. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say a couple of things. First, regarding Tyler's email, Professor Ford did take a lie detector test voluntarily about this, and Judge Kavanaugh has not, to my knowledge, testified under oath anywhere about this incident. And second, I wanted to say that the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, who at first did not appear to want to deal with this at all, have come to the point where they are having the two of them testify, which is at this point, I think, in an earlier, before this, it became something that they really couldn't avoid. And I think that, as your prosecutor has said, if the FBI were to look into this, that some other people might very well be found who could shed light on this. And I wanted to also say that I think Senator Collins, only going to the point of saying that the two of them should testify, I think that makes her a little questionable into what her highest motivation here is, that, you know, as to whether it's truly justice and getting to the truth or whether it's political, and that she, you know, she more would like to see the process move forward and Kavanaugh be confirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I think that's an excellent point. And thanks for bringing up the issue of Senator Collins. In political science, there was a man named Richard Fenno who used to write about Congress. And he said that one of the big responsibilities of members of Congress is what he called home style. It's the way that a member of Congress sort of creates a story about what kind of representative they are and how they go about doing that. And Senator Collins very much has a public identity, a home style, premised on the idea that she's an old-fashioned sort of main moderate conservative who takes issues on as they come. This case and the way the Judiciary Committee deals with it, I feel like, is going to be very central to her legacy, to the idea that she is concerned with, as I said before, the deliberative responsibilities of the Senate, with being able to not just move in as a partisan player, but to look at the circumstances, the context, the facts of a case, and decide upon that independently.
Bob, thank you for your call. We are going to take another quick break, but a word about tomorrow's program first. Join me and pioneering organic farmer Elliot Coleman. We'll be discussing the 30th edition of his landmark book, The New Organic Grower. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Corey Hill, proud sponsor of Poldark on Masterpiece. Season 4 premieres Sunday, September 30th on Maine Public Television. The law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. And Abbey Museum, Maine's only Smithsonian affiliate, open every day with a full schedule of family-friendly programs and workshops. AbbeyMuseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Derek Black, a former leader of the white nationalist movement. His father was a grand wizard of the KKK who created the white nationalist website Stormfront. Derek was considered the movement's heir apparent, but he quit in 2013. He's the subject of the new book, Rising Out of Hatred, by journalist Eli Saslow. We'll talk with both of them. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have World Affairs. Today, a panel discussion on the topic of global trust in the era of fake news and election interference. That's World Affairs coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, reaction to the issues raised by the Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination. My guests are Julie Lanjue-Peterson, Associate Professor of Psychology and Program Director of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of New England, Ron Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at USM, and Christine Thibault, Assistant District Attorney for Cumberland County. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. An email from Lou. Why do some people have such difficulty believing a woman's story of abuse from decades ago, but believe boys who were molested by clergy decades ago?
Well, first, I actually don't know what the evidence is that boys who have been abused by clergy are less likely to be believed in their stories or allegations of sexual assault and abuse as compared to women or girls or young women. So I just want to make that clear from the outset. What we do know is that people often don't believe women for a variety of reasons. Some of those have to do with, as I spoke about earlier, stereotypes we have about women. And I think some of those also have to do with just general old sexism, that, you know, women who challenge the status quo or challenge our beliefs about the world as a relatively safe, comfortable place for us to live are women who are viewed very harshly. And so it's difficult to accept that women are harassed, assaulted, and abused at really high rates in this country, as they are around the world, But in order for us to accept that, it makes us, it requires that we acknowledge that we live in a world in which one of us could be the victims of such type of assault, or one of our children, or one of our friends. And that's a really hard reality to swallow. I think the knee-jerk reaction is, particularly by groups of people who are less likely to be the victims of assault or abuse, that just can't possibly be true, or that there must be some sort of ulterior motivation. And this, you know, tends to happen when men in power are accused of sexual assault. It's hard for us to believe that they would have done that, or that the women accusing them aren't doing so for their own fame or fortune.
An email from Michael. Can you please explain to me why the Supreme Court, which has separate powers from the executive branch, is getting a nominee who has access to and is receiving counsel from White House attorneys? It seems to me this is a perfect way to inject partisanship into a supposedly nonpartisan activity.
Michael's totally right. There have been essentially a craft, a skill in the last, well, it probably started in the 1980s with Robert Bork, a skill within the White House of figuring out a way to get a nominee through the difficulty of the nomination process and through the Senate Judiciary Committee. And it involves terms that have become cliches already, the idea of judges as people who just call balls and strikes, the refusal to comment on any particular case because it might come before the court, talking a little bit about how sometimes you overturn precedent, and turning to one of the few cases that most Americans could agree was a good one, Brown v. Board, and the overturning of Plessy versus Ferguson. And I think that Michael is right. That has become very much a hyper-partisan aspect of the nomination process. But also at the end of the day, this is the way that the Constitution has set things up. The executive branch nominates people for these offices. The legislative branch confirms them. So the whole process is deeply involved with the workings of our elected institutions.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey there. Interesting show. This would ostensibly just be two people with different accounts of events years ago, but I think there's some factors that have come out that have not been mentioned in the show that lend more credibility to the accusers and less to the nominee. I'm particularly thinking of the yearbook entries of Judge Kavanaugh. He was in high school. But the five F's and the have you boofed yet and the devil's triangle that he put in the yearbook suggests that he was a bit of a bad boy and had a hard edge when it comes to sex matters, which is certainly not how he presented himself. He didn't say, when I was young and foolish, I was young and foolish, but these serious allegations I didn't do. And similarly, in prior confirmation hearings and under oath, it's very obvious he didn't tell the truth about receiving emails that were stolen. Initially, he said he didn't receive them at all. He didn't see them. Later on, he had to admit he saw them, he read them, but he didn't know they were stolen. The other stuff that he said about Judge Kaczynski, who had been sending inappropriate emails and telling inappropriate jokes to everyone on his staff and all of his clerks, and Judge Kavanaugh said he never saw them. He also said he was very close to Judge Kaczynski. I think that his attitude has been, you know, what happens at Georgetown Prep, what happens at Judge Kaczynski's chambers, et cetera, stays there. And that's how he's approached these hearings. And I don't think he can be believed.
John, thank you for calling with your opinion. We're going to go to Lenny. The Supreme Court should be peopled by the best of the best. It should take as long as it takes. The Republicans are accusing the Democrats of politicizing the process. Rushing Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, in my opinion, is the ultimate in politicizing the process.
Fair enough, I'd say.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from Brattleboro, Vermont. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm looking at this from a slightly different angle, and I have a question. I'm going to end with a question. But I'm the father of two daughters. They're teens. And I'm very happy that this conversation is going on because I want it to be a world, a society where you know, my son and my daughters are able to move forward and be safe and, you know, and live a fruitful lives. But, you know, when I look at this, it seems like to me that it's going to, there's a good chance when my guess would be that it's going to get pushed through eventually. And you know, I'd like to make sure that all stones are turned over and this and that. And if in my ideal world, if Kavanaugh's found to be a ride, that we stop it and derail the thing and wait and find somebody new. But from a different angle, it seems like we are having a time in which the election, the legitimacy of the election, is obviously being questioned. Guys all around the president are falling and turning, and there's all sorts of cooperation going on, and it's getting really hot and very, very close to the president. And my question is, you know, if you win the Olympics and you're found out that you cheated, you have your gold medal expunged. If you cheat on your taxes and it's found out by the IRS, they take away your, like what's happening to Paul Manafort, they've taken away the wealth that he earned from cheating. And it seems to me like that the president being able to name two Supreme Court justices, even though the legitimacy, the true legitimacy of the election is still seems to be up in the air, is my question, and this leads to my question, is there a mechanism for in the future, if they found out that the election was legitimate, that they say, wait a minute, you know, like these Supreme Court justice appointments were illegitimate?
Sure, Bob, and I think that's the point that Senator King has made, right, Ron? Even before the sexual assault allegations came out, he was questioning the legitimacy of Trump nominating this nominee.
Yes, and you can definitely make that argument. I mean, we don't get to take the presidency away from someone even when illegitimate behaviors occurred, in the same way that you can take away Paul Manafort's ill-gotten gains from him. It doesn't work that way. But you can certainly try to impeach, as was the case when, among all the other Watergate stuff, we learned that Richard Nixon had broken campaign finance laws. You can certainly try to do that. You can try to change the outcome of the next election. You can try to find a different way to set up the rules for the future. But our elected officials get to present their particular readings of the Constitution and see what they can manage. This is what Senator McConnell did in regard to the Supreme Court nomination of President Obama. So far, that seems to have actually worked out for him, although I don't know many people who take his point seriously as a constitutional argument.
Bob, thanks for your call. I'm going to read the end of an email from Mary. It's long, but she says, a person should have a better moral compass at age 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, or 17 than to engage in such behavior. Would we not prefer someone on the Supreme Court who has had a strong moral compass from their youth? This is not a trial. We are appointing someone who has a good job now to control women's bodies for the rest of his life. And Julie, this reminds me of something a friend of mine said. In his view, there are good eggs and there are bad eggs, and you know who's who. And if someone is some way in high school, what is their likelihood of being a different kind of person the rest of their life?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a social psychologist, so I'm, you know, trained to actually think the opposite, right? That we are the products of our social surroundings, that we are not born, you know, a particular type of person that carries us through our life, but rather we are shaped by those around us. I think what we're seeing with Kavanaugh, it's not as if his behavior is a surprise to most women, right? This is something that is really, really common. And I think also, you know, it makes me think of an article I read recently that made the suggestion that isn't it interesting that for many men in this country, sexual harassment and sexual assault is almost like a rite of passage for them, that it's something that was silly that they did in their youth, that they, you know, regretted later, and perhaps some didn't regret later, but that they eventually grew out of. But for the women or the men who are the victims of those behaviors, right, you don't get to just grow out of that. You experience that trauma forever. I think, you know, Dr. Blasey Ford's, you know, therapist notes, I think, are a great indication of that. You know, she is decades later talking about this to her therapist, whereas Brett Kavanaugh seems to think of this more as sort of a bump on the road to his success. And there was a point I think Christine made earlier about how, you know, we don't want the mistakes that adolescents make to necessarily follow them around forever. And I agree with that, and I believe it. But I also think that it is easier for some people to succeed with a storied past than others. You know, Brett Kavanaugh is very privileged in a lot of ways. And I think that this wasn't reported when it happened, that he was able to engage in these behaviors, at least allegedly, in college, and still able later in life to be as successful as he was, is also indicative of his socioeconomic status and his race and his gender and his sexual orientation. And so, you know, I think we need to take a critical eye to that and think about, you know, how we hold people accountable for their behavior in the past.
And to follow up on that, I think that there are two points of Brett Kavanaugh's behavior that we have to analyze. One is what happened when he was 17 or 19 in college, and then what's happening now? Because I agree with Julie that adolescents, though we don't really want to admit it, most adolescents are going to have errors in judgment, impulsive. That's the nature of adolescence. They do stupid things. They do bad things. The question is, how do they repair the harm, and how much character do they have as they go forward to be able to say, I hurt you, I'm sorry, what can I do to make it right? And so we're looking at behavior that happened, and it is tragically very common to have young adolescents, especially when alcohol is involved, do things that they shouldn't. But here we are now, 35 years later. How is Mr. Kavanaugh addressing that behavior and taking accountability for his behavior and trying to acknowledge what he's done? And I think that's where that notion of privilege comes in, that he may not feel that he necessarily has to apologize for what happened. But as Julie pointed out, Miss Blasey Ford doesn't get to just move on with her life. So
you may not. I'd like to point out for people, because this isn't television, that Julie and I are both nodding furiously.
And that's going to have to be our last word. Apologize to all of you. And there are many, many questions going unanswered here. The huge nationwide conversation, as we mentioned before. Thank you, Christine Tebow. You just heard from Cumberland County Assistant District Attorney and Supervising Attorney for the Juvenile Unit. Julie Lanjue Peterson, Associate Professor of Psychology and Program Director of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of New England. And Ron Schmidt, a Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. I have his new book in my hand, Reading Politics with Machiavelli. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, pioneering organic farmer Elliot Coleman. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.